I'm joined by the UN's Assistant High Commissioner for Refugees, Erica Feller. Erica, you've just got back from the Middle East. How many Syrians would you estimate are currently stuck at the borders?
It's very difficult to know that because we are not on the other side of the border, and the borders are in several hands. They're in the hands of the host countries, and they're also in the hands of those on the other side of the border who are controlling entrance in one way or another. So I would be very reluctant to hazard a guess. If you're talking about Turkey, Turkey itself has speculated that there might be between 5,000 to 10,000 people on the other side of the border at any one time. But you'll appreciate it's a very fluid situation, and people are moving to different parts of the border depending on how the border is controlled by whom.
Do you take that estimate at face value? Do you think it could be an underestimate?
I doubt it's an underestimate. I think the situation changes because you have to look at who these people might well be. And again, I speculate because we're not there and we don't have access. We only have access on the sides of the border in the host countries themselves. But clearly a lot of things are happening at the border. A country like Turkey has said that its border remains open. And clearly, if you take the fact that a number of people are coming in through Turkey on a daily basis, anything from 500 to more people coming across on a daily basis, I think that attests to the fact that it is open. Certainly, however, Turkey has a capacity problem. Certainly, there are people, groups that it cannot itself personally, as a country, control, who are probably controlling how many people at any one time can have access to the border. So there are sort of factors of this which are not known and make speculation doubtful. But I do also think that there are people who are coming to the border who are actually not seeking to come across. That was something that was discussed during my mission there and in other countries as well. But certainly at the Turkish border, there are people who are coming to access the assistance which is provided at the border and who want to have it and at the same time maintain their contact with their villages, with their families, and so are going back. So I think not everybody who may be at the border at any one time are seeking to come across it, if you understand what I mean.
Do you take Turkey's insistence that the borders are open at face value? The Human Rights Watch say that the people are being blocked.
We have said to all host countries, Turkey included, we have encouraged them strongly to keep their borders open to refugees from Syria. Of course, we have acknowledged the legitimate security concerns that all these governments have about the character of some of the people who may be seeking to come across the border. And we have stressed, nevertheless, that any controls at the border are supposed to be consistent with international refugee law, as well as human rights law, humanitarian law, that people who need it must have access to safety, and the principle of non-refoulement must be respected. And we have stressed that. We have no reason at the current time to doubt the sincerity of Turkey's position that its border is open and will remain open. We are confident that it will maintain this commitment. And we have said that if capacity is an issue and is impacting the rate of arrivals of people that they can actually receive, we would be prepared to step in and assist to boost capacity. So we have said that, you know, capacity should not be a reason for people being stuck at the border. We've also asked the Turkish authorities and others as well that if they stagger the rate of arrivals because of capacity, at a minimum, they ensure that the protection needs of vulnerable people can be met through access and entrance onto the territory of host states. So we have, you know, done our very best to encourage that the border remains open and that people who are particularly vulnerable have a first priority if arrivals are going to be staggered.
How has Turkey responded to that encouragement?
Turkey has said that it accepts that its border should remain open, and it will keep it open. And it is prepared to talk with us about processes to ensure, you know, vulnerable people are able to be prioritized. I mean, I was only there a few days ago, and this was part of the discussions we have. But as I said, anything that came out of the discussions was such as to give us confidence that Turkey meant what it said, even though it did have problems. The other thing I should say about Turkey, and I think it's very important to emphasize this, is that Turkey's generosity, and Turkey has actually maintained a very generous response towards Syrian refugees, having borne itself directly, as opposed to through the international community, the brunt of the burdens and responsibilities of hosting very large numbers of people. This does not come without a price. Turkey has agreed to participate in something that we call the Regional Response Plan, and it has done so on the basis that while it's been able to cope up until now, its coping capacities are being stretched to the limit. And therefore, it would appreciate, let me put it that way, it would appreciate greater solidarity with it in the form of international aid and assistance actually coming directly to Turkey. It has a relatively modest part of this international response plan compared to Jordan and Lebanon, and it is rather, and this was made clear to me when I was there, that it hasn't been particularly heartened by the response to date to Turkey. The focus is very much on countries other than Turkey, even though Turkey's burdens are actually quite high. I mean, there are some 111,000 or more than 111,000 Syrians currently, as of yesterday, registered with us for aid in Turkey. And there are the Turkish government suggests that there are also some 70,000 Syrians living in urban areas who are not directly registered for assistance, with us at least. And the figures are very, very high. And, you know, Turkey would appreciate some international assistance, which
sure.
they don't feel they're getting.
But if Turkey is illegally blocking the Syrians' right to asylum, why are you so reluctant to publicly criticize them?
Because we don't regard Turkey as illegally blocking Syria's right to asylum. We regard Turkey as making available asylum to Syrians on its territory. The pace at which it's doing that is to some extent consistent with its capacity to absorb, and we have said that we would become involved in any efforts to increase capacity, and we strongly encourage the international community to come to the party as well and assist to increase capacity. And at the same time, we understand Turkey's point that, you know, who comes across its border is not always in its own control, but there are other forces on the other side of the border who, for whatever reason, are blocking access to the border. So I think it's too simplistic, if you don't mind me suggesting that, it's too simplistic to say that the fact that there may be people not coming across who are waiting to come across are always waiting only because Turkey's blocking it.
I know you haven't had a chance to get into Syria, but can you give us any idea of what kind of conditions these people are stuck in, if they are stuck the other side of the border?
I can't really speculate on that because I haven't been there, and nor have we had access to that area. The only thing I can say is that there seem to be some NGOs, international NGOs, and also local Syrian NGOs working on the other side of the border in Syria, providing assistance, including shelter-type assistance, including in tents inside closed buildings, I mean inside buildings which are covered, so dealing, you know, in some way providing for people with as the weather's changing, etc. But I honestly would not want to speculate further than that. I have seen reports to that effect, but you know, as I said, I can't say definitively what the situation is like because we just don't have access to it.
You also travel to Lebanon, Jordan, and Iraq. Is that right?
Traveled to Lebanon and to Jordan. Didn't have time to actually go to Iraq, but we had our Iraq team responsible, not least, I mean, for many things in Iraq, but also for the situation at Al Qa'im in the central regions of Iraq and in Kurdistan, where there are also a camp and a lot of urban refugees. They came to Jordan, and we had consultations with them in Amman.
And is this an issue in those countries too?
You mean the border?
Yeah.
The border is closed currently in Iraq, in the central region, in the Anbar province region, where this Al Qa'im camp is, and it is not the same at all in the northern part of Iraq, in the Kurdish region, where the border is open, where people are coming in. So the main problem when you're talking about borders is in this Al Qa'im camp region of the country. The border there has had a checkered history. It has been at one point fully open, and then it's been partially open to certain categories of people, and then it's been very, very partially open, reserved only for very vulnerable people to come through, and currently it's closed. So this is something that our office is strongly advocating on with the Iraqi government, the opening of the border, even while, as in the case of Turkey, certainly in that part of the world, we do appreciate that there are serious security concerns for the government and that how they manage the border has to also address their security issues.
But you're reasonably happy with both Jordan and Lebanon?
Jordan, yes. In fact, I had the possibility of visiting the border area at night where we witnessed some 450 people come across. I was very impressed by the way the Jordanian military are handling that. We were driving along the border and we came across a man lying there who'd been shot in Syria, and his comrades had brought him in the dead of night across the border and left him to receive medical assistance in Jordan, and they'd already called an ambulance, a military ambulance, to pick him up. And I mean, there's a lot of support. We visited some of the collection centres. There are two collection centres we visited. They're called collection centres at the border in Jordan. Extremely impressed by the resources that the Jordanian military has employed to make these collection points, let me just put it one way, child-friendly, for example, a very extraordinary scene of children playing in the dead of night on swings and slides, etc., that they've put in place to sort of give an element of normalcy for the children who are arriving, and they're arriving in large numbers. Yes, I think Jordan is doing very well. In relation to Lebanon, mm-hmm. have no real concerns with the Lebanese border. The Lebanese border is open on the Lebanese side. I think the problems are on the Syrian side, where again there are obstacles from within Syria for some people crossing. It's also a fact that the Lebanese border areas are very insecure places for the people crossing. There's a lot of cross-border shelling and things like this, but that's a question of local insecurity rather than border closures or broad border policies. There are issues that you will read about, and we explored a bit with governments about the accessibility of territory to certain categories of people, and in particular single males. We were able to witness the sort of process of screening that does take place in Jordan in a center away from the collection centers by civilian police, not by the military, and where they identify from within this population who might be considered to be combatants, for example, and then they decide how differently to deal with the combatants as opposed to the so-called non-combatants. But the when we were there, there were large numbers of people, and nobody, at least that were identified to us, had been separated out for differential treatment at that point.
Did you get a chance to also visit the Turkish border?
Well, one of the camps we visited, Kilis camp, is right on the border.
Yep.
Literally on the border, so we were there, yes, and we had... there were people waiting to cross from Turkey back into Syria, and people who had come across, and then it was one of these zero aid distribution points, which I'm sure you know about, and so there was aid also being loaded onto trucks and things at the border.
And where are we up to now in terms of the numbers of people who have actually claimed refugee status in the neighbouring countries?
Well, I can give you the numbers registered with us. This is yesterday's figures, and as you'll appreciate, figures change on a very regular basis. But in Turkey, we've got 111,890 Syrians registered for aid with us. In Lebanon, the current figure is 113,787. I mean, you know, these figures are quite precise, and one has to take them also that they change at the level of individual. In Jordan, some 116,727. In relation to Iraq, the figure is, let me see, 47,590. So, yeah, those are the figures as of yesterday.
And if those figures represent capacity in Turkey's case, who else can help out? Are you lobbying the European Union, for example, to do more?
Yes. I do believe that the European Union should do more. I do believe that the international community, including the European Union, but going beyond the European Union, and there are a number of other big donors out there, should do more. I mean, Turkey is receiving some assistance. It's not that it's not receiving assistance, but relatively speaking, the situation in Turkey is rather under the radar rather than except at the border where, as I said, there are a number of issues that one has to consider. But I would also say to those who read your article, for example, that I think the front face of this Syrian crisis is the camp situations, for example, the camp in Jordan, Zaatari camp. But I think the hidden emergency, if I can put it that way, is the many, many more people who are in urban environments, living in squalid houses or shelters. I mean, we visited one in Lebanon where the individuals had constructed it themselves out of cardboard and pieces of wood, etc. And you know, there's a lot of misery and unaddressed problems amongst the urban Syrians, and increasingly the urban population is increasing while the camp population, you know, is a changing population. So while I'm not underestimating the challenges for people living in camps, I would really strongly encourage that the international community also turns its attention to the plight of the urban refugees from Syria.
What more can the international community, the European Union, do? I mean, could refugees be bused to Europe? How can they help?
No, I don't think they can be bused to Europe for the time being. But I think there can be more focus on the sorts of programs that are necessary to enhance the coping capacities of host countries, receiving children into the education system, making the health system more accessible and more responsive to the kind of problems that the Syrian population is bringing with them, the psychosocial and trauma-type problems. Shelter is a huge challenge in a number of countries.
If this is going to go on for months and months, you know, what kind of contingency plans have you got for that eventuality?
Well, we are trying to shore up our capacity to map, to reach out into the urban population and map the problems. And there are a number of problems which are already starting to emerge. We're trying to strengthen partnerships at the local level to reinforce the coping capacity of, you know, the local institutions, the health institutions, the education institutions, to take that too. And we are trying to develop a more overarching network of partners, both implementing partners, but also partners inside the country, to really, because these people are widely spread, they don't easily come forward. One of the key entrance points into a situation like this is the registration process, and we have huge registration challenges in a number of these countries, just having seen the problems in Jordan, where we have something like 500 people a day massing outside our relatively small office in a narrow street in Amman. We were trying to open a new registration facility which brings registration closer to the point of early arrival rather than people having to come and register with us. Why is registration important? Because, for example, people need a UNHCR registration certificate to get their children into schools, to access subsidized health care, etc. So registration is a key first step for a number of these people, and the accessibility of registration for some of them is a challenge. Letting them know about the significance of registration and how to access it is another, etc. So reinforcing UNHCR's registration capacity, which has been made pivotal in the response of states in the region, is quite an important initiative that we're currently looking at
And just finally, what do you fear is going to happen if some of these measures are not taken?
I fear multiplicity of problems building up. And, you know, protection problems can be incredibly serious and long-term for many people. Sexual and gender-based violence, problems relating to protection of children, etc. They need to be invested in early. And if the focus continues to be predominantly on camps and assistance programs in camps, as opposed to getting into the communities and trying to deal with these problems before they multiply, set in and intensify, you know, I think you can have a humanitarian emergency.
Okay, Erica, thank you very much for spending so much time. Thank you.
No problem.